Cadillac chickens out, test driving Chevy's Cruise diesel, and Lutz's new book makes for required reading.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by the 2013 Hyundai Elantra. Learn more at Hyundai.com.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy, episode 203 for July 12th of 2013. Fiat's 500L, the cavernous compact. Watch Autoline After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Peter D.
John, how are you?
I'm doing good. How about you?
I'm doing very well.
Good to hear. And we should let the audience know we've got Doug Guthrie from the Detroit News, the auto critic for the Detroit News, with us today.
I know. You add critic to your name and you just put a target on your back. That's all.
And you just got back from driving the new Mercedes S-Class.
Yes. Yes, I did.
Well, I want to get into that in a minute. But first, I want to go back to Peter's rant on his website last week about Cadillac killing the CL, a car that we've talked about on this show a lot for the last 2 years.
Yeah. Well, General Motors upper management decided that the ultimate Cadillac... Well, first of all, they spun it this way, that, well, it wasn't special enough from our new 7 Series S-Class fighter to justify, which was total ridiculous, you know, PR speak. The bottom line is, you know, Akerson is a cost cutter, and they've been cutting little niggly details in that car for a year.
You know, talked about that, yeah. How they were trying to take a bunch of cost out of the interior.
Yeah, there
of the
was
car.
Some big horrendous fight over $5 in the interior. Now, if this is a car that's going to be $125,000 to $140,000, I mean, what the hell are they thinking? But, you know, it's just Cadillac has spent 14 years trying to resurrect themselves. And, you know, they've gotten to the point where they're in the conversation. Have they gotten all the way there? No. The problem is I think Akerson and his cronies' mindset were that we have to make a real business case for this. You know, this is going on. We're going to have to make money. I said, no, they didn't. They had to make a statement, a definitive statement for the brand going forward. And they had the perfect platform to do it with the stunning CL. We've seen it in person. I inadvertently stumbled across a silver sedan version of it.
Yeah, because what they had released was only a convertible.
Yeah, but I saw a visual representation of a sedan version of it, which was probably even more stunning. And they just decided that they weren't in the business of making cars. They were in the business of making money. And John, this segs into what you were talking about with Alfred Sloan, the famous General Motors chairman.
The most famous chairman in the history of General Motors, who was chairman from roughly 1921 to 1956, something like
arguably
that.
Arguably the architect of all of GM's, you know, he was architect of the product ladder, a car for every person purpose. I mean, this guy was...
created the industry. I mean, Henry Ford, okay, put the world on wheels, but Sloan's often given the credit of really creating the auto industry as we know it. But you're right. I ran across this really fascinating historical tidbit. You know, just like when President Eisenhower left the White House, what was his last speech? It was a warning. Don't let the military-industrial complex take over. Yeah. And Sloan had an analogous kind of speech when he left General Motors in the late 50s. He said, do not make financially-based decisions, especially when it comes to new product. So here you are saying...
And Sloan was a finance guy.
And he was a finance guy. But he knew that if you wanted to create desirability, if you wanted to create a brand that was aspirational, You had to have killer product. Yeah. And if you did that, the product, the profits would come. Yeah. But if you try to niggle every nickel and dime on, especially a Cadillac brand, forget it. You're never going to have an exclusive brand.
Yeah, and, you know, and maybe the Germans do it to the extreme the other way. I mean, they build what they want to build because they believe in it, and then they believe the profits will come after that. And, you know, for the most part, they're right.
They're right. And they have financial controls. They have cost cutting. But it's not nickel and dime stuff.
No. And it was just disheartening. You know, you and I both know a lot of the true believers who do great work in GM and are talented, the designers, the engineers, the product development people. And it has to be really disheartening because, you know, it would be nice to see an American manufacturer do a no apologies take on, you know, it's the famous Porsche line that they've run about once a decade in a print ad, everything we know so far. And that is what I wanted GM to do through Cadillac. Now, we've also talked about doing a small batch mid-engine Corvette that would do the same thing. They don't feel the need for that. But until they do, GM will always have these intermittent bursts of really cool things, C7, the CTS-V. You know, they did a fine job in the ATS. You know, they have the true believers keep them in the game. But, you know, when it comes to making the big statement, and this is who we are, this is what we're capable of doing, most importantly, this is what we believe in. They won't do it.
Not happening. Doug, what do you make of all this, of Cadillac killing the CL?
Well, I spoke with Ed Wilburn at the show, the Detroit show in January, and I noticed that CL was back there in the back corner again, second time in a row. And I said, are you, you're going to bring a larger car. Everything says you're going to bring a larger car. Is this it? And his response to me was, oh, no, we'll do much better than that. I mean, they believed that it was coming, and that suddenly that the brakes come on. When I write a review about General Motors products, I get more criticism than on any other brand, any other label, because the hatred for government motors, Obama motors,
it's still palpable. It is
very strong, and I think they're being very careful. And unfortunately, you're right. You build a halo car not to sell a lot of them. You build it to show off. And this car was going to show off. And people were still, there were going to be a handful of people who bought it. And if it broke, they could afford to fix it.
It's unfortunate. Because it would have said a lot about Detroit. You know, it would have said a lot.
Well, the other thing, too, is when you create a halo car and you do it right and you bring up the prestige of the brand, you bring up the residual values, you bring up the value of everything that you sell.
Yeah.
Well, you can make a profit. Viper makes a profit, $2,500 to $3,000 a year, and they still make money on that car.
Right. So that's a good segue. You just got out of the new S-Class Mercedes. What do you think of what they've done with it?
There it is. It's a halo. It's everything they know up to this moment. The car has been, the design, the exterior design of the car has been just stylistically changed a little bit. They're following the new design language, which is basically to change the character line on the side of the car. Instead of diving down like it used to, it gave that aggressive forward look. Now it goes up and down. So it gives a more relaxed, upright feel. And I talked with some of the designers about that. That's their intention. They're trying to talk about comfort. But what the car does is innovation. It has sensor fusion, is what they're calling it.
What's that?
Sensor fusion is taking all of the data that cars now collect. This car has 8 separate cameras on board. It has 2 infrared cameras. It has infrared light projectors underneath the headlight array. The headlight array is so incredibly complicated that Leonardo da Vinci would be just proud as all get out. These cameras, the data is being analyzed from the images, and the infrared is heat-sensing infrared camera. The other one is night vision. The dash display is entirely digital, although it doesn't look like it.
The interior is quite handsome.
It is very horizontal and it's entirely leather wrapped. I was told there are some artificial surfaces in friction points in the seat. But other than that, they told me that they did exist. But that it's even got sort of a quilt perforation in the dashboard. It's very unusual, very, very stunning. But the sensors will collect long-distance, there are long-distance radars, sensors, all sorts of things on there, and it analyzes it and then sends it to several different units to do different things. The intelligent drive system recognizes things like a deer or a human being off in the distance in the dark. Then it spotlights it on the dashboard in red, in an image that it shows you from the camera, highlights it. At the same time it's doing that, the headlights are rotating and, through the miracle of science, sending a flash, a pulse of LED light that spotlights the individual. Now, that might not have a good effect on a deer, but on a human being, it says, look, I'm coming. And it also, from the cockpit, shows you this person. Hmm. There are devices inside the headlights driven by servos that shade the light. You don't have to worry about dimming your light because the cameras can see the windshield of the oncoming car before you do. And a shade rotates to hide your light from the windshield. And as it goes by, then it drops. And my first thought is, when it breaks, that's going to cost a lot of money. But halfway through this drive, I begin to realize, I can't afford this car. The people who can afford to fix it.
Is it the closest thing to an autonomous car we have yet?
So far. But you have to keep your hands on the wheel at all times. I think you get, 8 seconds that you can have your hands off the wheel?
You take your hands off the wheel, and it'll rotate through gentle turns. You're driving down the road, and it keeps the car. I got so confident in it that I had such a light grip on the wheel that it began to warn me several times that I needed to be participating. And because I just got so confident in it, as you're driving down the road, the Distronic cruise control slows you down and then speeds you up, depending on what's in front of you. And the electric power steering is controlled so that it keeps you centered in the lane. And if you do have to have your hands in it, it is keeping track. And if you don't have some input within 10 seconds, it gives you a warning. If you wander out of the lanes, it gives you a nudge back. But if you've really wandered out of the lanes, the ABS on the other side will apply and pull you back into the lane. The red light comes on. It's quite shocking. It's close. The Acura RLX was capable of making big round expressway turns. I let go of the wheel on that thing, and it did just drive itself through the bigger turns. And then eventually, I don't know how long that took, but a big warning comes on that's very clearly coming from the lawyers saying, no, take a hold of the wheel. We've been warned to tell you.
But that's a good point, whether it's on the Mercedes or any of the other cars coming. All those warnings and the limitations of it are lawyer limitations. They're not technologically limited. They're legally limited.
Well, that's what I was told by some General Motors people when I went out in the Cadillac, which is they have an autonomously driving Cadillac, and I took a ride in that, and literally a ride because the car takes you around the track. That what it's going to take is for changes in the law. That they can take control of the car, but it's going to be defeated. Somebody's going to get hurt somehow in that car, and then they get sued. We promised that we could drive the car, and the fact that I think that they said that the computers that were necessary to make it operate were going to be about $100,000 per copy. So it was
no.
And the price of that's going to drive down.
The big expense, if you want full autonomous like Google's doing, then you have a LIDAR. It's like a laser radar. Think of it that way. And the units that are available now, they're these almost look like these spinning flower pots on top of the cars that are fully autonomous. And they're about $70,000. But they're hand-built. You know, this is not a mass production kind of product yet.
Price would come way down.
So the price is going to come way down, no question.
Well, the new S-Class has the ability to stay in the lanes, not just by following the markers, which is what everybody else is doing. The cameras are recognizing the lane markers. The S-Class, when the lane markers are absent, will pick up on the car ahead. and try to analyze whether that car is in the lane. If it takes a radical departure, it no longer follows it.
Well, remember when we had Jeff Owens here from Delphi, and we were talking about autonomy, and they're getting into it all, and my question was, what about when there's snow on the ground? He says, that's solved. That's resolved. That's not an issue anymore. So,
well, GPS.
You know,
using GPS.
Right.
Are we going to arrive at the day, one day, where you literally have to, you know, people who get their driver's license will have to be indoctrinated out and actually physically drive a car because they won't have any frame of reference?
Yeah, I think we're headed to that day, but it's going to be decades away. I mean, I think we'll see autonomous cars within the decade, but to the point where people no longer know how to drive or anything like that, it'll happen, but it's not going to happen within the next decade. But just as if you go back 100 years ago, people were worried, oh, geez, if these horseless carriages catch on, who's going to be able to drive a team of horses? So we're at that point right now with autonomous cars.
Maybe we have autonomous driving lanes. So, because what I've heard is that the fear of the mix of a computer-controlled group of cars and humans, and that humans cannot respond in the same way.
And these the rogue element, cars like could. Me or John driving our 700 horsepower something or others.
Yeah, our 918 Porsches, right?
Well, you could switch on full autonomous drive, and you could have a line of cars running 6 inches apart.
I don't think you need that, Doug. I know everybody keeps talking about that, but I point out that Google has now racked up 400,000 test miles with its small fleet of autonomous cars, just running out on roads without an incident.
It got run into from behind.
It got run into, right. So, but I'm saying the autonomous technology has worked brilliantly in Google's test. There will be failures. There will be people killed in autonomous cars. There will be lawsuits. So what? There's lawsuits anyway.
I'm in favor of a lot of the technology that takes the cell phone out of people's hands, text messaging, voice composition, that sort of thing. It's controversial. People say, well, that's still a distraction. Anything that takes the autonomous cars, you give the end product, which is safe, no accident driving. You provide that to Congress, and they're going to get rid of the nut that holds the wheel. That's us.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's proven over 90%. In fact, some studies say 95% of all traffic accidents are driver error.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, enough of autonomy. We talk too much about that, I think, on this show. I got a chance to drive the Chevy Cruze diesel in the last week, and that was an interesting test drive. I'm sure you've been in that too, Doug.
I drove it to Indianapolis. My drive was to go down to the 500. And
oh, so very interesting. So you were a lot of highway driving.
I got, as I recall,
because that's a real boring drive.
Well, I took my son along, and he's a police officer, so he's my get-out-of-jail-free card. But we didn't go very fast. We took it easy, and it didn't get the advertised mileage, and it hates to go slow. You get into a traffic jam, and you can watch on the indicated. You can watch that mileage fall. It's been tuned to be Americanized. It gets great mileage on the highway, and it does not get very good mileage in stop and go.
I got, without a whole lot of highway driving, I got a combined 36 miles per gallon. Mm-hmm. On the highway at a steady 70 on flat stretches of road, I was seeing 55 miles to the gallon.
Yeah, it really goes up there. My only problem with the Cruze, which is a nice platform, it's a very nice car. In fact, the one that I was in was even done in cocoa and light tan. It looked like a Volkswagen inside. I was surprised. It looks like a Jetta. My only complaint was that on that long trip, the seat wasn't good for me. It was a bit of a brick, and the same for my son, who is much taller than me. So I don't know. Seats are something that's truly individual. But other than that, it's a nice car. It's quiet inside, extremely quiet inside for a diesel.
Yeah, but I found it noisy at idle. Mm. And I found there if you're at a dead stop or very low speed and you got to jump on the thing, whew, there's turbo lag. Oh my God, I was surprised at that. But if you just accelerate away from a light with a light throttle, the torque just keeps coming and coming and coming. So it drives like a large displacement engine if you drive it that way, which I think most Americans. That's how they want to drive. They don't want this little four-banger winding way out, or most people don't. I like it, but most people don't. But this diesel, man, it's just loafing along.
It is. The RPMs are way low. My neighbor girl, who's 5 years old, told she came walking up with her dad to look at the car, and she did say, "Daddy, that car's too loud." So outside, it's loud. Inside, Chevy's done a really good job of trying to make their cars a lot quieter with lots of new seals, lots of new insulation. And I think inside, it seemed quieter than I expected, and very smooth.
Hey, one other topic I wanted to hit on before we bring on our guest is I just read Bob Lutz's new book, Icons and Idiots. And boy, I got to tell you, everybody in the industry should read this. It's the best book he's done. I burst out laughing through several spots on it. And it's all he's doing is writing about the bosses he worked for. And I knew some of them. Red Poling at Ford, Phil Caldwell. In fact, Phil Caldwell, we just got the word today, just died at age 93. Von Kuhnheim at BMW, Lee Iacocca, Rick Wagner and the like. But it's very interesting insight. And we're going to have Lutz here, I want to say, in 3 weeks or something like that.
No, longer than that.
Longer than that? Okay. But anyway, got Lutz coming on the show. But I don't know if you guys have seen or read the book, but I highly recommend it.
I've just read excerpts, but I'll read it before Bob gets here.
Yeah, you know, in his other books, he's been pontificating and, you know, all these theories and blah, blah, which has been fine. But this is more almost like a life story, but learning lessons of leadership as you go along. Like I said, really good book. I highly recommend it.
August 1st.
Chip Drake, our producer, just told me August 1st, Bob Lutz will be here.
Okay, it's a good time to...
Let's segue. Let's give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone, Ben. Yeah, we're joined right now with Art Anderson, the chief engineer on the Fiat 500L.
Hi, guys. Nice to be here.
Great to have you here. Now I got to get this straightened out. You say chief engineer, but you're not really the chief engineer, right? I mean, this car was done in Italy, right?
Well, it was designed, styled in Italy with Fiat. The program came along before Chrysler was in the picture. So the assembly plant went up. It's built in Serbia and styled the car. And then after we got together, there was a big question, do we want to bring the car to NAFTA? And to do that job, it's been a long time since Fiat directly brought a car into this market.
Which means... a lot of modifications
massive
to do that,
changes.
I imagine.
There's several changes in the car, absolutely. The powertrain, 160 horsepower, 1.4 multi-air turbocharged engine. That's about 80 horsepower more than what's in the base car in Europe. We're starting at really good. That's our base engine in the car. Then simple things like all-season tires, that's the standard here in Europe. It's summer tires and winter tires. So you have to go in, tune the car, do all these things to bring it up to what the market really wants here. And then, you know, we go through all the details of even the material selections on the seats, the tuning, suspension ride of the car. We went to frequency-sensitive dampers on the car to be able to deal with American potholes.
Yeah, how different is the suspension? Quite a bit?
It's tuned quite a bit differently.
Yeah.
It really is, because you can imagine we put you know, the extra horsepower in the car. Bigger brakes, bigger calipers, a lot more stopping power, and we had to tune it to bring all that in.
Yeah.
So we still protected all the fun-to-drive stuff that's there in the car, and with the extra horsepower, it comes out. But you get that, the comfort, the quietness, the good ride that's in the car.
How about crash standards? Did you have to modify it to meet U.S. crash standards?
Yes, we did have to make some changes. The unbelted 208, for instance, is a completely unique standard for the NAFTA market. We had to make all those changes, tuning of the restraints. Also, all of the warning messages, onboard diagnostics, all of those things. And then on the rear of the car, we've got the high-speed rear impact. So the rear structure of the car is modified for that with a flat floor, underslung, available spare tire that goes under there, which in Europe is kind of... not the prime direction in that market. So
a lot of changes to the car.
Yeah, there's...
So you're legitimately a chief engineer.
For all of those pieces, yes. And there's, I would say, over 200 unique major systems in the car that we've modified.
So is it front wheel and all wheel?
No, it's front wheel drive.
Just front wheel?
Yeah.
And how many, like, basic versions? I know you have a lot of variations off each version, but how many versions are there?
There are four trim classes for the car. It starts at the pop, which starts at $19,900 for the six-speed manual. And then it walks up to the easy, what they call the easy, the trucking, which is more of a kind of a off-road appearance, a little tougher. It's got different unique wheel. It's got wheel arch cladding.
Kind of a Subaru-esque competitor there.
Well, I don't know if I would say Subaru, but it's a little more. There's a trekking line in the Fiat brand.
Right.
If you go look at those, they're a little more.
I know what you're saying. A little rugged.
A little more rugged looking, and then the one that we have at the top is the lounge, and I think overall it tops out close to 26,500. That's including, you know, the Euro Twin Clutch, which is also an addition for this market, and then the full-size sunroof, leather, rear camera, 6.5 Uconnect system with the nav.
Which one is this?
All the options.
Pop?
This one is the Pop, yes.
Yeah, we've got a car in the studio with us here, and it's bigger. It looks bigger in the studio than it does out on the street.
I think it looks pretty big out on the road. I've seen a bunch of them on the road. I think it looks pretty big on the road.
Yeah, it's a very efficient package. It's got a we call it B segment only because of the the market script, but it's very efficient with the space on the inside. There's over 120 cubic feet of space.
That's the story of this car. I think you get inside and you can't believe how big it is.
Right, and we've opened it up a lot on the inside. It's got the split A pillar, so you have very little obstruction for visibility around the car, and then you've got tremendous headspace in the car. You know, it's 27 inches longer than the normal 500 that most people know right now. So it's 27 inches longer, 6 inches wider, 6 inches taller. And it's got 42% more interior space in the car.
The other thing is the windshield is really in three sections.
Yeah.
And when you're sitting in the driver's seat or the passenger seat, I mean, it feels like you're in some massive Winnebago or something. Just visually, that's what it sort of tells you. You've got this massive panorama in front of you.
Yeah, it's very open and light, and car gets good aerodynamics because of that, and also you get good visibility. It also, the design guys love it because then they get this floating roof look because the glass goes black when you look at it a little bit of a distance. So you take that, you combine it with our available white and black two-tone roof, and you get that very clean appearance that they love.
So how would you rate this differentiated from the 500 as opposed to the Countryman's differentiated from the Mini?
Oh, good question.
Because to me, I mean, when I look at this, I don't think 500. I think of a new segment Fiat to this market. And I just wonder, is that juxtaposition as severe as the Mini and the Countryman? I'm just asking.
I think this is a more severe differentiation from the 500 to the 500L than from the Mini to
the
Countryman, right?
Yeah, I mean, we've...
Well, this is a totally different platform.
It's a completely different platform.
It's the Panda platform, right?
No, this is actually one up from that. The 500 is on the Mini platform, which is common with the Panda. This is the small wide, which is the next size up for a platform. So this is the first vehicle off of that architecture.
Okay. Huh.
Did this start with a Giulietta like the Dart did?
If you go back, it starts with... Not the Giulietta. The Giulietta is the next one up. So this would start with the Punto, which is the small. Punto Evo is the small, and then it's the small wide. So this shares a lot of the basic components with that platform itself, things like steering columns, steering gears. But most of the other parts have been tuned up to meet the cause. So
I've driven Dart, and I've driven this car.
Mm-hmm.
This car is livelier than Dart with that same engine. Is it lighter?
They're actually about the same weight. What is going on there, I think, is the seating position's a little bit higher, which makes it have a different feel.
Feels there.
And the tuning of the car is a little different. It's you know, spatially, it's an interesting package because it's a small footprint on the outside, Big space on the inside, lots of utility, and we're still bringing it with 33 miles per gallon highway on either the manual or the Euro twin clutch. So it's kind of fitting a place that I think there's a lot of open space in the market, and the dealers are really excited to have this other offering.
Well, yeah, I would imagine the dealers are thrilled. I've noticed the black trim on the corner of the front end. Is there an aero thing going on with that, or is that just the way you did it?
There's two things going on there. That is for pedestrian impact in Europe. It has what we call a K-point out on the front. It's got that little point.
So it kicks your feet up in the air, right, instead of running over you?
Right. Well, from a real technical standpoint, you know, when they did the pedestrian impact stuff, when it first started with regulations, they discovered through all the research that the big expensive injury was the knee injuries. They take a long time. They cost a lot of money for people to recover. The strategy is that you knock the foot loose from the ground, and then you don't bend the knee. So if you do get hit, it's a much safer event. But that's the reason it's required.
This just in. Don't walk in front of cars. How about that?
I agree.
They're going to break your ankle.
Yeah, I mean, come on.
So that carried over from the European side of the regulatory stuff. But it does have a unique face. It's got the bigger opening for the cooling, bigger horsepower. So
down the road, thoughts to putting any other engines in this?
Not at this point. There is a transmission. There's a conventional 6-speed automatic that'll come along a little later. For the folks that want to be more traditional and make that selection, obviously you're going to give up some fuel economy to do that. We've done a phenomenal job, I think, with the tuning of the Euro twin clutch. It's a new tuning that basically says that if you're driving the car and you go up to 30 miles an hour and you lift your foot off the pedal, it doesn't give you the upshift like a lot of automatic transmission will. It will wait. And then when you come back and you tip in, if you tip in lightly, you'll get the upshift. If you tip in heavy, it'll keep you right there. So it makes the car very drivable, fun to drive.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think you've learned a lot from Dart because this one is tuned way sharper.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's evolving technology, and we take at our house, you know, in our company, we take everything and just keep improving it. We have to. It's a very competitive environment.
What is the lounge the way? I mean, what's the curb weight on the lounge?
The curb weight on the lounge is 3250.
That's pretty light.
Well, especially when you look at the amount of utility and space that's in the car.
That's what I'm saying, for the size that it is.
Yeah.
How much cargo space with the rear seats in place?
The rear seats in place, I don't have that number exactly. I can get it. But
probably still enough room behind the back seats for four or five bags of groceries.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of space. The back seat has a lot of feature sets in it. It's adjustable fore aft, folds down, and it tumbles. The load floor in the back has two positions, a lower and an upper. And the front seat also folds down.
The right front.
So if you want to put a long ladder or the occasional 2x4 from the lumberyard, it'll take it. The versatility and the flexibility is built into the package. It's kind of a key attribute for us. But the cargo space inside the car is really huge.
Is it for sale now?
It is. It is at the dealers right now, and we're
starting to get there.
It's been there, I think, for about 2 weeks. They're really getting into the market. The dealers are happy with the way they're moving, for sure. And people are enjoying them right now.
Where is it built again?
It's built in Krajevec, Serbia.
Now, that's not the old Zastava plant, is it, where they made the Yugo?
It actually is. There's a major, major economic development process that went on. Fiat took the plant from
Zastava. Because remember, the Yugo was actually an old Fiat.
That I'm not sure of.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was. Yeah, wasn't it like a 124 or something like
was.
That?
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's been Fiat connections to that plant going way back. That's
right.
Why I asked if
that was it. But I've been there, and the plant is basically it's been completely overhauled. It's all new building, all new stamping
I'm glad
line.
To hear that, Art, because when I was there... Boy, I got stories to tell you about what that place was like when I was there.
Well, I can imagine. But you can imagine how important it was to the culture there, because after the war that went on there, it's important to get people back to work, give them a life, a way to have a means to move forward and improve. And I've been there, and the plant is absolutely new. There's a stamping line there, a 2,500-ton Komatsu stamping line that the floor is epoxy white. When the doors are closed, you're standing there, you cannot even hear the line running.
Wow.
So it's really a clean, modern plant that's running there right now.
So does each level have different wheels, or is there like one alloy wheel? Or
We have a wide array of wheels. We've got, it starts with a base 16 and a cover.
Is that what that is?
It is. It is. And then it goes to an alloy, and then there's two 17s. Excuse me, three 17s that are available. There's a very wide array of...
So the lounge gets 17 alloys, your choice of 17 alloys?
Yeah, when you get to the 17, they're both alloys. So you get to the alloy wheel pretty quick. You know, in the brand lineup, you got projector lamps, you got a lot of premium features that are built into the Fiat brand. Even the 500 and then the 500L carry those through that are completely different than what is in the European cars, for sure.
I've been amazed at how close the Fiat brand in the U.S. has come to Mini with just the 500. I never thought that would happen. I'm even speculating that with this car, you guys might catch Mini in sales.
Where's Mini at right now?
I want to say Mini is in the high 40,000s. And, yeah, I wish I had the numbers right in front of me to be able to quote it exactly. But when the 500 came out, I thought, boy, if they can do 16,000-18,000 a year, that's good. And I want to say last year Fiat did twice that many. I want to say it was in the mid-30,000s or something like that. So I'm thinking this car could really propel the brand forward.
Yeah, we're thinking that a lot of new customers for this car. It's going to be very competitive, great fuel economy, great package, and try the car. If you try it, I think a lot of people are going to be happy.
What do you see as your main competitors in the market?
Well, if you look in this segment, there's a couple of places other people can go. The Kia Soul, which is pretty much the entry point, and then there's the Mini Countryman. But I do have to say, you know, we start with 160 horsepower. Mini Countryman starts at 121, and quite honestly, if you look at the feature sets that are in the car, we are more than competitive. So those are the two big volume movers in that current segment right now.
The Scion XB is there.
It's also there. It's a smaller volume, I think, right now, and it is
because sales-proof.
It is very polarizing. I mean, it's either...
No, I'm telling you, the whole Scion brand is dying on the vine. The XB is going nowhere right now in the U.S. market.
So much of this has to do with how you market the car, what the image of that car is. Your Fiat 500 was a sexy Italian, and the Abarth became even sexier. This car, the advertising for this car, if you've seen any of them, is very clever. Again... Family sexy.
Yes.
And then I saw the one with the Italians are coming.
Yes.
The Revolutionary Era community, and the guy, Paul Revere, instead of saying the British are coming, he starts with the British are coming, and then he ends up saying, it's the Italians. The Italians are coming, and it's these guys coming over the hill.
And everybody's happy.
The whole town transforms. They're knocking the teacups off the table and putting up cappuccino, and the women are tearing off their...
bonnets.
Their bonnets, and... And at the end, they're standing there saying, this is going to be so much more fun than the tea party.
I agree.
Once again, it's a DART advertising campaign, not doing so well. Fiat, very clever and doing very well. It's so much of it is image before they'll ever get a chance to try the car. Are you satisfied with this? Do you think that that's the magic it's going to take?
For this car?
For this car.
I think you're spot on. You have to have something that engages people. They need to want to know more about it, learn about it. I think the ads that are running right now are very creative. We have very gifted people doing that right now. And I think when they see those, they're going to want to know more. They go try the car, and it's going to be honest and live up to what the promise is and all of that. So I think it's a very honest, valid step to add this car into the market.
I think it'll do well. I've driven it ever so briefly in Chrysler Proving Grounds, but it put a smile on my face. And when the two guys in our shop here who went out to the media launch for it came back, they were raving about the car. So that's a good indication of how a vehicle will do in the marketplace. Yeah. I think a very good early sign.
Yeah, yeah, I think so too. We hope so.
If people are afraid of the dual clutch, I drove the dual clutch and I drove the stick shift. The dual clutch is peppier. The dual clutch is smoother. The stick shift makes the engine feel slow. It's jaunty, but I thought that the dual clutch was tuned so much better than the Dart was, and it makes the car feel very responsive.
Yeah, the twin clutch does a good job of giving you the torque flow, keeping you on the power, reading what you're doing with the throttle, and staying right there with you, keeping you on the right peak points. And we've done a lot of work to make sure that's optimized. That's been one of the biggest tuning elements that we had going on.
Oh, that was my feeling, was get the dual clutch and spend $995 for that giant sunroof.
And it is giant, right?
It is huge. Right.
Hey, I know we've got a bunch of viewers out there dying to ask you a bunch of questions. So let's get to rapid fire. But first, we've got to give a shout out to our friends at Hyundai.
I can do this.
This one. A sedan. Coupe?
Yes. Nope.
Wow. The GT is nice.
Yeah. I can't figure out which.
An easy decision just got harder.
What's happening?
Sorry about that. The Elantra. Now also available in Coupe and GT.
Oh, boy.
From Hyundai.
Okay, it's time for a rapid fire. Let's let it rip. Okay, Art, JJ's the first one up. He wants to know, will there be a 500L Arbart?
Oh, that's would only be speculation.
We don't mind speculating on this show, as you've been able to.
Sure.
I won't press you on that anymore then. Glenn E. wants to know, does the 500L require premium fuel?
It does not, if you want the best performance, and it would be recommended to use the premium fuel, but does it require it? No.
He also wants to know, what about a 4x4?
No, sir.
There isn't one, not even over in Europe?
No, sir. No.
Okay.
No.
Let's see. Dr. Botox wants to know, how do you think the 500L will compare to the Honda Fit in comparisons?
The Honda Fit. I think it'll do pretty well. It's got a lot more character. It is not a commodity punched out.
Well, I don't think the Fit's a commodity necessarily. The Fit's a fun driving car.
Right, but it's a little more of the, there's a certain shape to those cars, right? I think that
Fit's not this big, right?
No. The Fit's a smaller car. Right?
Fit's a smaller car, also, and I think they'll like this a lot more. We've got more character, a little more performance, 160 horsepower, and we've got the European styling, the Fiat part of it. You're part of that that brand not being more of a commodity car. So I think there's a lot of difference between the two cars.
Yeah. Hey, we've got some phone calls here. Ben, let's bring in the first one.
Hi, Gary Emke from Fremont, Nebraska, a retired Ford mechanic of 44 years. And I would like to know why Ford Motor Company, with regards to the Ford Edge, comparing with the Chevrolet Traverse, why Ford does not have a three-row version of that vehicle. Around our area, the Chevrolet Traverse is just selling like hotcakes. And that's what I would like to know about. I'm watching the show with Chris Prius right now. Thank you.
Doug, you want to tackle that? Why no three rows in the Edge?
Because they don't fit.
Yeah.
I mean, you're just going to end up with complaints. They fit in the Explorer, and that works very nicely.
Yeah, buy an Explorer or look at the Flex.
Or the Flex. No, and I think that's the real answer. Ford has said all along that they designed that, that the the edge for two rows. And to Doug's point, if you tried to squeeze three in there, it wouldn't work. Mm-hmm. So you got Explorer, which is the real competitor to the Chevy Traverse anyway. Well, and you've got the Flex.
My question is, how long does the Edge last? That platform. You know, they're trying to move everything onto global platforms. When will Ford move their mid-sized crossover to the Fusion platform? Mm-hmm. How long is that going to take?
Well, and the Escape is doing very well, so who knows?
Don't mess with it. It's amortized. You're making a profit. Leave it alone.
Making money, right. Don't rock the boat.
Chrysler 200.
Jonathan Brown wants to know, how many of these Fiat 500Ls do you expect to sell a year?
I think at the moment they're looking at something that's, I think kind of in the, well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure of the number, the projections, but I think it's going to be pretty robust. Depends on where things go with the market here, I think.
Okay. Mike D. White wants to know, were you originally a Chrysler engineer?
I started in Chrysler in January of 84. So I am originally a Chrysler engineer from Purdue University. So mechanical engineer.
You're a lifer.
I am. I actually
a Boilermaker.
And I started in Highland Park.
In the Big
at the old building, yeah.
Yeah.
Big Ten.
Yeah, I've been there a while.
Rum and Coke wants to know, do you go home and dream of engineering Hemi Challengers?
Well, I actually was lucky enough that I got to work on the architecture when we set up the car to do that job. So I did get to do that. So, yeah, there's some dreaming that goes on. All the fun
when
stuff.
When you were working on the Hemi Challengers, you were dreaming of doing a Fiat 500L, right?
Well, it moves over time.
Right.
The next one, right?
Hey, we've got another phoner here. Ben, let's bring it in.
Hi, John. Paul Stewart here. Got a question about the Fiat L. By the way, I'm a longtime listener, well over 10, I think almost 15 years since we've been on PBS.
Cool.
Could you ask your guest, is the Fiat L made in Serbia or down in the Mexico plant? I think it's a Serbian plant. And I had read in Just Auto, the news website for businesses, that the Serbian plant had some problems several months ago with some irate employees. I'm just curious. It was either that or a supplier for the Serbian plant. And I just wondered if everything has been waxed out and fine over there. And thanks very much, and have a great show, and hope to watch you in the future. Thanks so much for your time. Bye-bye.
So did you guys have problems at the Serbian plant? He said irate workers. He wasn't sure if it was a supplier to the plant, though.
Well, there was a report that I had seen on the wire. There was one employee that scratched some initials into the side of a body. Was just a single event, and somehow it got on the wire. So, but there's absolutely no trouble there at all. It's really, the people are great. They really want to make a good product, and there's no issues.
Okay.
Somebody probably tweeted a picture of it, and then it gets out into the regular media.
Sure, yeah.
Welcome to modern media. Everybody's a journalist.
Right. Peter, here's one for you. Brian says, do you guys think GM's boneheaded decision with the CL opens up an opportunity for Lincoln somewhere down the line?
I think that's pretty premature for Lincoln. I think their product cadences, they couldn't even embrace that. I think the furthest out for Lincoln is a replacement for the S, and that'll be their chance to at least be put themselves in the game with a distinctive sedan, but they're not going to be looking at doing an ultimate halo.
First, they got to prove that they can sell the Z and the C when it comes, and then the new S, you know. Yeah. And if they get a few successes under their belt,
I actually think the C is going to be a huge hit.
No kidding,
yeah.
A hit.
Yeah, I think it's going
to be. I like the way it looks if the production version ends up like the concept.
Yeah.
What'd you think of the C?
I think the C is beautiful. Now, those pedestal seats are gone, that interior's gone, but it's modern art inside. I don't like the capacitive touch screens because it takes your eyes off the road. That's my complaint about my Ford Touch.
Although the C is going to have the new take on my Ford Touch. Hmm. It's going to have their fixed version with buttons and knobs.
So redundancy. Okay, well, you can reach over and grab those without
having
to look.
Driving past your exit. But yeah, the sea is beautiful, and it took Cadillac 10 years to get this far, and Lincoln's just started that process.
Yeah, so they're we won't see a halo car from Lincoln for a long,
this
long
decade.
Time.
Yeah, probably no. Not this decade.
No.
Wright Knight wants to know, Art, will there be a future larger 600 model coming?
Well, there's always kind of speculation, but you can imagine at the Fiat Studios, they're going to fill up the showroom with all kinds of different product. But no, that's not that I know, but there's all kinds of future products.
Fiat dealers can't live with two-segment vehicles alone.
No. They need a broader...
Unless they're just going to go to a certain point and
hold it there.
And hold it there.
They have long suffered to get this car, to get a second car. And even though it's got the same name, 500, it's a completely different car. It's interesting you're marketing it the same way under the same name because it's so different. Will the Alfa be... Will one of the Alfa Romeos be next for their showrooms?
That's speculation. You'll have to ask our CEO about that.
This is to Peter and Doug. Did you guys see that Opel Monza coupe design?
Mm-hmm.
What'd you think of that?
It's cool. It's not as exciting as the Audi Quattro supercar that they're doing. That thing is just awesome.
Yeah, this was a question I should add from a guy named Bill Smith. Have you seen the pictures of the Monza at all?
I saw a picture of the nose. Yeah. That's all I've seen. And anything that can draw attention for Opel is a good idea.
Yeah. I thought it looked fantastic, nose that I saw. I thought it looked brilliant. But
it's
no.
Cool, but, when you think about it, of late anyway, GM hasn't had a problem with design. I mean, they can do design when they want to do it.
It's the rest of the stuff.
It's the rest of the stuff.
That's right. Hey, looks like we've got another phone call. Let's bring that in.
Hi, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. GM recently announced that they were no longer going to publicly report monthly production figures, and instead we're going to report monthly wholesale deliveries, I believe. What does the panel think? Should GM be applauded for this, becoming more transparent, or is this no big deal? Thanks.
Yeah, that's a good question, and they're becoming less transparent, not more. GM is the only manufacturer that has said it will not publish production numbers, the only one. And all the analysts, I can tell you, are tearing their hair out over this one. They are praying that the rest of the industry does not follow suit. And it's not just the analysts, it's the supplier community, too, because GM gives them forecasts of what they've got to supply, and the suppliers don't always trust what the automaker gives them, so they check that against what actually gets built, and they use that for their forecast going forward. So the supplier community's up in arms about this, too. I think it's not a good move. GM claims that it's now selling cars all over the world, so if the analyst community looks at the production of a car and figures out what the retail price will be and calculates what the profit will be and then run all those numbers and forecast what the earnings per share will be, GM claims this is going to be inaccurate. So they're dropping it. The only one who seems to believe that so far. So what GM is saying now is we're not going to do production numbers. We're only going to report sales or deliveries in the country where the vehicle was sold. I think it's probably better for them from an internal basis, but I'm telling you, the analyst community and the suppliers do not like this move at all.
Well, that's going to make apples and oranges comparisons from now on. I mean, year-end figures, that'll affect everything, won't it?
Well, no, because remember, you've got sales, deliveries, mm-hmm. and versus production. And those two numbers never exactly match up. I mean, somewhere theoretically down the line, they got to match up because every car that gets built gets sold. They don't take it apart at the end of the year and send all the parts back to the suppliers. Every car that gets built gets sold. But there is always a lag time between what gets produced and what actually gets sold. So GM's doing this literally to stiff-arm the financial community. That's why they're doing it. That's my read of it, anyway. And I'm telling you, the analyst community and the suppliers do not like this move at all. Let's see. Westride wants to know, what's the difference in fuel economy between the 500 and the 500L?
I don't know the numbers on the 500. I've been too busy working on the 500L. The manual's 3325, and the Euro twin clutch is 3324. For the 500L, I think there's a model on the 500 that gets up to 40, I believe, highway. But it's on the website. If they really want to know the detail, it's right on the Fiat website. Yeah,
good to know. Some of our viewers have been listening to me speculate as to what the sales are. Eric Ambrose sent in. He said in May, Mini sold 5,944, almost 6,000. Fiat did about 4,000. But Eric Main from Public Relations is here. Eric, what were those numbers again for last year?
43,780 in
2012. So Fiat did almost 44,000 in the U.S. last year.
Correct. And it took certain other brands 7 years to break the 40,000.
And he won't mention Mini, but he said it took Mini 7 years to hit that number. So Fiat's off to a good start, no question about it. And, hey, I see we've got another phone call here. Ben, let's bring that one in.
And one last question, John. Paul Stewart, another question. On the upgraded engine for the Dart next year, when will it appear? Early in 2014, early spring? And do you think it'll be the same V6 that's in the new Jeep Cherokee next year? I think it's like 270, 260 horse. Or will it be just an upgraded Turbo 2.4 Tiger Shark, what they call it? Thanks very much. And I'm hoping for the stronger V6. What do you think?
I think you're going to be disappointed. Doug, you handle that one.
From what I understand, it doesn't fit. The V6 won't fit in that platform. But and I'm not sure exactly which one's coming, but my understanding is that it's an upgraded 2.4, that it's a larger turbo, and that it'll have, I don't know how much, but that car needs more horsepower. That car has way more suspension than power, and it could use it. And I'm not sure what it is that's coming, but my understanding is the V6 won't fit.
Ah, very interesting. So we're not going to ask you that question, because we know that you guys don't comment about future product. Right. So we learned that a long time ago.
Unless you trick them.
Hey, this is probably a good place to wrap up the show. But, Art, thanks so much for coming on the show and for bringing 500L into the studio. It's awesome.
Thanks, guys. It's always awesome to talk about the car, for sure.
Great.
We love it.
And, Doug, great to have you on, too,
yeah,
man.
Doug, this is fun.
Yeah. Good. Great having you on here. And, Peter, good seeing you.
Good to be here.
We should let everybody know there will not be a regularly scheduled Autoline After Hours next week, because we're going to do our automotive fantasy draft that's running on Tuesday at 7 p.m., a little bit different there. And, of course, that's a number of us fantasizing about, if we had our own car companies, where would we put them? Where would we build the cars? Who would be in the car companies? And in fact, right after this show, we're going to have Art. Did we get all that approved, Chip? Mm-hmm. Art's going to pick out the name for the sequence of the draw. So we're going to get to that in just a minute here. You won't see it live, but it'll be on Monday's Autoline Daily. So I just want to thank everybody for having tuned in.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion. And by the 2013 Hyundai Elantra. Learn more at Hyundai.com.
Visit our website, Autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at Autoline.tv.